Today I want to introduce to you Annette Ermschar. Annette is a licensed clinical psychologist with a specialization in neuropsychology and forensic psychology. So,
thank you.
Welcome, Annette.
Thank you very much. So just a quick raise of hands, how many of you are MFTs in the room? Most of you? And note the ones who are not MFTs, what other groups are you? Is there any?
LCSO.
Okay, yeah. Great. Any others?
Just a JD.
A JD?
Trainee.
Oh, okay. I thought, well, good. I needed a legal advice here. But okay, great. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to meet you all. I do some clinical practice in terms of treatment. I do a lot of assessment, and I do a lot of forensic work, testifying in court, and I do a lot of sex offender risk assessments, as well as other types of legal evaluations. I know that most of you know a little bit about sexuality in general. I won't be talking about that. I know most of you know a lot about healthy sexuality, sexual issues. I'm not going to be talking about that. I'm going to move more into sexual disorders and specifically then highlight on how it moves into sexual offenses from a legal perspective. And of course, all of our sexual issues that we work with can sometimes come into matters of law. It moves into illegal behavior. And so that's kind of what I'm going to focus on today. And I know we all know DSM, so I'm going to move through it really quickly. In general, paraphilic disorders involve all the sexual disorders as well as some of the sex offenses. Paraphilia itself is just an intense and persistent sexual interest in others, and it doesn't become an actual disorder until it's clinically distressing to the person or causes some sort of harm. And so we're moving into the disorders. And I think we all know about these. What's important, though, is voyeuristic, exhibitionistic, and frauderistic disorders are considered the non-contact sex offenses. And if caught, those are obviously, you know, crimes. But they tend to be, obviously, the least severe of the crimes in the sexual offense categories. But what's important about them is they are very correlated with escalation in terms of later more serious sexual acts and sexual contact offenses. So while I don't happen to see very many of them in the types of evaluations I do, primarily because the courts sort of either manage them quickly and there's not a whole lot of outcome or court cases surrounding them, but I often see them in the histories of individuals with more serious sex offenses, including violent sex offenses as well as possession of child porn. And I think in a treatment milieu, we probably see more individuals who have possession of porn, which is not illegal, but possession of child porn, which is illegal. I think we tend to see that a little bit more than you're going to see, you know, a rapist, because they don't tend to be out and about as much. But so sexual masochistic sadism, you know, I think that we often see those in our clinical practice, but it doesn't come to legal issues until it obviously becomes non-consensual. Okay, moving on to a pedophile. I'm going to spend a little more time on that. Pedophilia is recurrent and intense sexual arousal, fantasies and urges, and behaviors towards prepubescent children. And that's important because generally when you're talking about a pedophile, pedophilia, a pedophile is someone who has these sexual interests, urges, or behaviors to children, usually considered age 13 or younger. Some people would argue age 12 or younger. But again, prepubescent, so you wouldn't expect the development of secondary sex characteristics in terms of the children that pedophiles are sexually aroused to. Now, there's a couple types of pedophiles. One is exclusively sexually attracted to children. That's all they're sexually attracted to. And not exclusive, which means they are sexually aroused to children, but they're also sexually aroused to any number of other age groups, including adults their same age. And they could be attracted to males, females, or both. Or the third type is it's limited to incest alone. In other words, the only sexually arousing interest they have is to familial members, their own children, their stepchildren, so incest within the family. Okay. There's a bunch of other types of paraphilias. I'm not going to get into these because I really don't see them that often in my cases, although I have to say to you, I just did a case not too long ago at Patton State Hospital where he murdered his mother and then raped her, which is necrophilia, which is actually a felony, to rape a corpse, because of course it's non-consenting. And so that was a really interesting case, and of course an enhancement to the murder, which was already significant. So as you can imagine, there was probably some psychiatric issues there. But more interesting than the psychiatric issues was the dynamics between him and his mother throughout childhood, kind of looking at her personality and sort of the inappropriate sexual boundaries that developed between the two of them from long ago. And so for me, when I'm looking at a sex offender, or anyone with sexual problems that sort of rise to the level of something illegal, you know, it's very interesting to look at it in a broader context, their relationships with their mother, with their friends, with their family, and their past. Okay, there are a few limitations to using the DSM, and in particular, in the legal system, we try to avoid using the DSM exclusively, and we certainly try to limit using the DSM as the justification for our opinions, because the DSM is not designed to support or make legal decisions. It's not necessarily consistent with how the penal code thinks, the types of verbiage that's in the penal code. So what the penal code considers to be a mental disease, defect, or disorder, which is the words that the penal code uses, does not necessarily relate to whether there's a DSM-5 diagnosis or not. There are many types of clients who the court will conceive of as having a mental disease, defect, or disorder, but they don't fit into any DSM-5 category. So there's a lot of limitations in the DSM-5, particularly from a psycholegal perspective. But also just more generally, the DSM-5 does not capture all types of sexual issues and problems that people face. And also, it sort of doesn't help us look at the difference between pedophiles, the types of pedophiles, and looking at child molesters versus pedophiles. The DSM doesn't really talk about child molesters. Pedophiles may or may not be child molesters, because a pedophile simply has a recurrent sexual arousal and interest to a child, fantasies, but they don't necessarily have to behave on those. So they can be a pedophile, but never molest. And I think that that's one of the myths, is that all pedophiles are child molesters, and then the reverse is also not true. All child molesters are not pedophiles. Plenty of people are opportunistic. And when the situation arises, they will take advantage of it. And it doesn't matter the age or the gender or for that matter, whether it's a human or not, to engage in their sexual interests. And so a lot of child molesters actually are not pedophiles. And a lot of pedophiles are not child molesters. So I think that's important for me to note here. And lastly, only a small percentage of pedophiles are exclusively aroused to children. A lot of pedophiles have arousals to many different age groups. Okay, so let's look at a few typologies or types of sex offenders. And I'm going to kind of whiz through these. They're in your handouts. I want to get to some other stuff a little bit here. But there are adult male child molesters, both situational and preferential. Situational adult male child molesters tend to have personalities that involve a lot of low self-esteem, really poor coping skills. They tend to be interested in sexual experimentation. Anything in front of them is fair game, so they tend to be more situational. And they tend to be social misfits, very inadequate socially. Preferential child molesters are the types of pedophiles that spend their time in grooming behaviors. I think we probably all heard of grooming behaviors, but those are behaviors where the offender will take quite a bit of time prepping the environment, prepping the child for a future offense, prepping the child's parents or mother or family members for moving into the family and being able to offend, and then prepping the environment. So grooming behaviors are very consistent with adult male child molesters who have preferential interest or sole interest in children, which is a smaller percentage of pedophiles. Okay, and they do sometimes tend to be sadistic, which is basically just that they're aroused by the pain of their partners. Adult male rapists, so we're out of the child category here for a minute. There's a couple different types, and I think we've probably all seen this in the literature, but some rapists are very focused on power and reassurance. They have poor masculinity, poor sense of self as a male, which is a better way of saying it. They feel very inadequate, and so they use forced sexual activity as a way to reassure themselves and feel more masculine. Power assertive, rape is really thought to be an act of power and dominance. So power assertive use rape to express their power and machismo. Anger retaliatory, some adult male rapists rape because they have significant anger towards women, often rooted in childhood. And they use rape as a weapon to degrade women based on sort of their own internal model of females. Anger excitement is obvious, they derive pleasure. Opportunistic rapists, they may be committing other crimes and rape is just sort of convenience. So in the midst of another crime, there happens to be a woman there, well, why not take advantage of this? And gang rape, and actually in gang rape, you should know that other than the leader, most of the individuals involved in gang rape are really reluctant to participate. But they do so because the leader is sort of more of the power assertive type. So I do a lot of cases where there's gang rape, and so it's really common for the attorney, and for that matter, the judge, to ask for psychological evaluations on all the members who are involved in the gang rape. Because often you'll see that there's a lot of followers, a lot of kids who are have lower intelligence, who often don't make decisions for themselves. They're sort of used by the one or two predatory gang members. And so it's really important to just look at, well, to what extent were they was there an intent to do so versus just following along? Not that that's not a felony, but it's treated and sentenced a little bit different. Adult male hands-off offenders, and again, these ones have no contact with the victims, but these are often precursors to later more serious crimes. Okay, adult males who engage in the collection and viewing of child pornography. And this is becoming much more of a problem, or may I say, much more recognized as a problem. Perhaps it was always a problem, but the government is really interested in focusing its resources on cracking down on the possession of child porn. There's a lot of internet sting operations that I've been involved in. The FBI is very involved in monitoring internet downloads, I've seen dozens of sting operations where they'll just come in the house and confiscate the computer, and there are thousands and thousands of pictures downloaded of various child pornography pictures, and boy, that's tough evidence to dispute in a court of law, right? So, but there's also a lot of sting operations where, you know, government officials engaged in sort of looking to entice someone to meet and greet a minor. And so I'm involved in those as well. Okay. So opportunistic men who have child porn don't tend to have this as their primary sexual arousal, but in times of stress, they will move towards more viewing of child pornography. Collectors tend to be more of the compulsive types. They will collect and collect and collect large collections of child pornographic pictures and videos. They tend to have a lot of failed adult relationships. They're very socially isolated. They don't have a lot of friends. They spend a lot of their time on the internet and on the computer, hours and hours and hours a day. The collector molester moves from the collection to actually molesting. So there's a lot of individuals who are males who have child pornographic pictures on their computers, but they would probably never act out on it. The collector is not necessarily a child molester. It's still a felony, though, with a lot of time. The sentences are pretty harsh. But the next step is to actually be so aroused by it that that's no longer satisfying. And as with any addiction, we want more and more. And so it tends to be more addictive in nature, and they become more compulsive, and so their interest and addiction moves to the next best thing, which is to go actually get it rather than just look at it. So they then will engage in molestation. Producer profiteers, I mean, it is true that individuals who produce child pornography often have pedophilic interests. And then the traveler, they're really looking to connect with children online and make arrangements to meet them in person. So they're a little less interested in child porn, but actually going out and finding them. So they frequent schools and parks a lot. And you'll see signs in parks that say, you are not allowed to be in a park if you're not with a kid. You've seen those now, yeah. Sort of in direct response to this. Adult female sex offenders, they exist. Surprise, surprise. Sort of a myth. I think most people think that they don't exist. Patton State Hospital houses the one sexually violent predator in the state of California. To be a sexually violent predator, you have to have engaged in, obviously, you know, significant sex crimes and have a serious mental illness. And those sex crimes are significant and very dangerous. So, you know, there are female sex offenders, but they tend to be more in these categories. The male coerced is a small percentage of them, which is they're with a male who is coercing them to collaborate in child abuse, and so it's in conjunction with a male. So the female wouldn't have done so on her own, but feels powerless against the male. Predisposed, they tend to abuse their own children. And they do so because of a lack of intimacy and a need to connect. And so with their child is the person they feel the most connected to. Very poor boundaries, obviously. But they are so drawn up in the connection and the poor boundary that it moves them to an emotional intimacy that's inappropriate. And I've actually done a lot of those cases. I did a case probably about 4 or 5 months ago of a mom who has been sexually involved with her son since puberty. And at the time I evaluated her, he was 23. And they had continued the relationship until he finally reported it, because he's like, had sort of grown up enough to know that something was wrong here. So, you know, that's like 13 to 23, that's like 10 years of abuse. And so it sort of started and grew from there with, you know, sleeping together and being very emotionally intimate and physically intimate, which a lot of great mothers are, nothing wrong with that. And then she's like, I couldn't... It just felt so good. I felt so close to him, and it just seemed so natural, and I wanted more. And so her boundaries were very poor. And then she moved into sort of this teacher-lover kind of mentality, which it can be mothers, but is often teachers. But in her case, she was a mother who really wanted to teach him about sexuality, and she wanted to teach him about, you know, the male, female private parts. And so she, you know, would have her son explore her vagina, and, you know, she would teach him how big the vagina was, and that he used to be in her tummy, and see his head was yay big, and it was small enough to come out of her vagina, and why didn't you feel around in there? So you kind of get a sense for what that is. And so it was really just teaching him about female sexual anatomy that obviously was... inappropriate, and moved into greater and greater escalation. And then she said, you should taste it so that you know, and let me then train you, and you should know how to, you know, give good oral sex, because you might later have a wife. So it was very much of a teacher role, but it progressed into a relationship. But the teacher lover is often, in fact, an academic teacher, and this is probably the most common in terms of females. They have a history of abusive relationships with men, and they're drawn to the connection that they have with their students, and they usually engage in more and more inappropriate boundary violations with male students. There's a lot of sort of famous cases of that, and you've probably seen them on the news. Okay, adolescent male sexual abusers. I do a lot of work in juvenile court. Adolescents can be very antisocial, you know, a juvenile delinquent, embedded in other crimes. They engage in rape or, you know, other things. The emotionally isolated and disturbed adolescent, the shy, reserved, sort of poor social relationships adolescent who has poor boundaries, has poor sense of what's appropriate, and, you know, just sort of the aggressive juvenile. I'm not going to spend too much time with juveniles. I mentioned grooming earlier. Grooming is a big problem in the criminal justice system, because a lot of times they will inappropriately use things that look like grooming behavior to try to prove that abuse occurred. So this most often happens in cases of child abuse, lewd and lascivious behavior against a child. It's called Penal Code 288. Lewd and lascivious. It could be anything from just touching, fondling, to digital penetration, vaginal penetration, anything. And in Penal Code 288, they're trying to prove that the child abuse occurred. Now, the problem is the victim is a child. And so the reliability of children's statements are often called into question. Not to say that we don't believe children. We absolutely do believe children. But we also recognize that the younger the child is, the poorer their verbal skills are, the poorer their memory is. And all of us have failed memories at times and recap something slightly incorrectly. But certainly the younger the child is, the less their brain is developed to really capture memories. In fact, the hippocampus, which is a structure in the brain that translates short-term memories into long-term memories, is often not even fully developed at the time that children are reporting abuse. So their ability to accurately capture something that is persuasive to a jury is sometimes in question. And so the prosecutor will use other ways to prove that the sexual abuse occurred outside of just the child's statements, because they're not often as reliable. And so one thing that the prosecution does is say, see, you can see evidence of these grooming behaviors. Well, the problem is that if you look at the grooming literature on what grooming behaviors are, there is no typical profile. And often groomers who are pedophiles have behaviors and look exactly the same as pro-social men who are good teachers, good fathers, Boy Scout leaders. And you know, what do good teachers do? What do Boy Scout leaders do? In a sense, they groom the kid, not to sexually abuse them, but they try to gain rapport with them, gain trust with them, you know, build the relationship, you know, offer them various incentives, all the way from, you know, time together, let me help you with baseball, to, you know, I noticed that, you know, your family struggles at home, what can I do to help? I mean, you know, good teachers and Pathfinder leaders and Boy Scout leaders and the such, and church leaders will do behaviors that can look identical to the grooming behaviors of a pedophile. So it's problematic to use in court because there's nothing that differentiates those two men. If I know sexual abuse has occurred, and it's not contested, it's not up for debate, then it's much easier to look at the grooming behaviors and say, see, here's grooming. We know that the abuse occurred. It's not in a court of law. But if it's in a court of law where we don't know for sure whether it occurred or not, right, because there could be false allegations made for all sorts of reasons, namely people who have their own sex abuse histories and often have a hard time differentiating between their own stuff and their kids' stuff, to, you know, divorce cases where sometimes, you know, one parent wants to paint the other parent in less appealing light. There's a lot of reasons why allegations of sexual abuse may not be founded, right? And so if we don't know that the sexual abuse has occurred and it's the jury's decision to decide, not ours, then you have to be really careful about looking at research like this, because there's really no research that differentiates between pedophiles and other pro-social men. So, okay, moving on. Myth, sex offenders reoffend at a high rate. Once you've done it, you're probably gonna do it again. The truth is that, and when I say the word reoffend, it's the same as the word recidivate. They mean the same thing. So when you're talking about recidivism rates, you're talking about what is the likelihood that they're gonna do it again. The courts are very interested in this, right? If they're going to give someone probation or parole or an alternative sentence, they want to be sure that they're not going to do it again. So the assessment of recidivism probability or probability for reoffense is something the court's very interested in. The truth is that research suggests that most sex offenders do not reoffend sexually over time. After 20 years, this is a little bit of an old stat, and I think there's a few newer stats, but they're not that different. Most sex offenders do not reoffend. After 20 years, 73% of sex offenders had not been charged with or convicted of another sexual offense. It's a little problematic, because how do you know that it didn't occur? All we know is that there's they haven't been charged with or convicted of it.
They didn't call.
Yeah. So it's a little problematic as a data point, but you know, it's the best we have as science, right? So there's problems in any science. But look here, lots of studies, there's all sorts of studies looking at this. Before I go through this chart, see on the right it says predicted rates. The courts want to know, what is the likelihood that this person will reoffend? Can you predict it for me, Dr. Armshar? My answer is always no, I'm not in the business of prediction. I do not have a crystal ball and I cannot read the future. But what I can tell you is that there are risk factors that correlate with recidivism. And I'm going to talk about those risk factors. So let's think of it kind of like a civil engineer would look at a bridge. How likely is that bridge going to fall next year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, right? A city wants to know that. Is this bridge sound? Do you think any civil engineer is going to go look at that bridge and say, I'm going to tell you it's going to fall next year in March? No one would do that because they can't predict the future. What are they going to do? They're going to look at the bridge and they're going to look at factors that are associated with bridges falling, like the fact that it's made of wood rather than steel, right? Wood rots, wood deteriorates. That's a risk factor. Age, if it's 280 years old, it's probably more risky than something that was built 20 years ago. So you get my point. Number of cars that go over a bridge. A bridge that only gets, you know, 4 cars a day is a lot different than, you know, a bridge that's used by, you know, high traffic, etc. There are factors that you look at to help with that decision. In sex offender risk assessment, we're looking at the number of factors that correlate with doing it again. And in our predicted rates, we always overpredict. Our instruments, our tools, our assessment instruments are not very savvy. We're not great at predicting the future as a field. Psychiatry and psychology are not great at predicting these things. But we try our best based on the science we're given. But at 5 years, most risk assessment tests that I would administer would say this person has a 20 to 30% chance of recidivating. In fact, official rates show that only 14% actually recidivate. So if I'm evaluating Joe Smith for his chances of recidivating, because the court has asked me to do so, I'm probably not doing him very well. I'm not doing well by him, because I'm probably more likely to say he's going to recidivate than he actually is. In 10 years, 20% recidivate, but we would predict 30 to 35, etc. So point being is that we still as a science are not great at predicting recidivism. We do so through the use of risk assessments, which I'm now going to talk about. Yes?
Dr. Armshar, are you aware of any efforts at researching based on, say, giving convicted sex offenders immunity and then asking them to self-report if they've reoffended? Because we do know that the arrest rate and it's so low.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Like this. We don't know for sure that it didn't happen, right? Because they might not have admitted it.
Yeah.
All we know is they weren't rearrested.
So,
yeah.
Okay, so have people endeavored to say, okay, you're not going to get in trouble for anything you tell me, but have you done this, or this?
Yes, in less severe offenses.
Okay.
Offenses where the community is less likely to have a response.
Mm-hmm.
Not with a whole lot of success yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's an excellent question, though. So when we're looking at, yeah.
Hi, you had mentioned the example of the bridge,
yeah,
all the different factors,
yes,
you would look at.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the different factors that come into play?
Two more slides.
Okay, got it.
Yes.
Thank you.
So when we're looking at risk factors, there's two types, and then I'm going to get to them. Two types of risk factors are static risk factors that are things about the person's history that can't be changed. Being a male is a risk factor. Men are more likely to recidivate than a female offender. Can you change the fact that you're biologically male? Right. You know, so in general, that's a historical factor that's harder to change, shall we say. Dynamic risk factors are things that are easier to change. The fact that I have a mental illness is easier to change, arguably, than the fact that I am not young anymore. So being young is actually a historical risk factor. The younger you are, you're more likely to recidivate. Maybe that one's better than male versus female. Can you change the fact that at 21 you recidivated? You're 21, you can't change that. That's a risk factor. But I can change the fact that that 21-year-old had bipolar disorder and was highly impulsive, and in his impulsivity, he engaged in compulsive behaviors. That can be medicated, treated, managed, etc., through all of us in this room. But I can't treat the fact that he was young when his first crime occurred. So risk factor that's things I can't change, risk factors that are things that I can change. Early on, we used to do risk assessments that were based only on risk factors that we couldn't change. That's problematic because in 5 years, he may have a ton of treatment and I re-administer this risk assessment and his risk level is still the same. Why? Because it doesn't matter how much treatment I give him, those risk factors, being a male, being young at the time that he committed the crime, not living with parents during childhood, that's a risk factor. He can't change that. So his risk is still gonna look the same, yet he's gone through great treatment. That's a problem. So over time, we've recognized this and we've integrated dynamic risk factors so that with change, their risk levels should be reduced. Let me just tell you, the field of risk assessment is so interesting. Back in the 80s, the courts were making psychology and psychiatry do all sorts of risk assessments, making predictions about recidivism. There was an amicus brief filed, a friendly report to the federal court, written by the American Psychiatric Association, collaboratively, under the direction of John Monahan. And this amicus brief report to the federal court said, "Your honors, we are not good at predicting recidivism. Please don't ask us to do so. It's not beneficial to a court of law because we're not good at it. In fact, the accuracy in the 80s was 33% accuracy." Oh my gosh, if I'm only accurate at my opinion in 33% of the time, I would be better served by flipping a coin. What's my accuracy when I flip a coin? 50%. I would be better saying, does this person have a risk for recidivism? Flip a coin, yes or no? I would be better to do that than to use the risk assessment instruments that we had in the 80s. That's scary. So the APA appropriately sent this report to the Supreme Court saying, don't ask us to do this. This is not science. Guess what they said? Case Estelle v. Smith in the 80s. Supreme Court came back and said, thank you for your report, doctors, but to change this would be something akin to disinventing the wheel, written right in the court of law. So please continue to do so.
Oh.
I kid you not. So John Monahan and his colleague Stedman said, oh my God, if we're gonna be asked to do this, we better up our game. We better improve our measures. So in the 80s, there was this huge task force that was improving the quality of risk assessments amongst forensic psychologists and psychiatrists, introducing risk factors that allowed us to look at a person more dynamically. So here's your answer. What are the most common risk factors, and this is just a short list, there's so many more, but having a prior sex offense, having a prior non-sexual offense. So people who've engaged in any non-sexual offense, what are non-sexual offenses? Burglary, robbery, you name it, assault, spousal abuse, right? Those are non-sexual. Having prior non-contact sex offenses, voyeurism, frauderism, exhibitionism, increases your risk. Having a male victim, I like how I put a boy, but really it should say male. Having a male victim increases your risk. People who offend against girls or females tend to be less risky than those who offend against boys. Having an unrelated victim, unrelated meaning not biologically or familially related, like no children, no stepkids. So like your friend's kids, they're unrelated, but you know them. That's actually more risky than abusing your own kids. So intrafamilial sexual abuse tends to get less harsher sentences because the research shows they're probably less likely to do it again. Mm-hmm. Whereas having unrelated victims are probably more likely to do it as a risk factor. Mm-hmm. Stranger victims, people you don't know, makes you very risky. Being young at the time you engage in your first sex act, adolescents, juvenile sex offenders, very risky for, you know, lifelong offenses. Whereas, you know, I just did this case where his first time ever charged, he's 71. And he's charged with fondling his granddaughter. His daughter and he are highly conflictual and she is very angry at him for some financial reasons. And so she brought up the allegation. So the question is, did he really do this? And that is so unusual for a 71-year-old who has absolutely no history of anyone reporting anything of the likes in his life, never a concern about him with kids, to now start at 71, highly unlikely. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but. Cohabitation history, people who are married or who live with a intimate partner are less risky. Having a history of child behavior problems is a risk factor. Being separated from your parents as a child, in fact, right here in the risk assessment instruments, if you didn't live with your both biological parents until the age of 16, it increases your risk.
Why
I bet you
that?
Many of us, mm-hmm. you know, didn't live with both biological parents until we were 16. But that's a risk factor.
Why
so
is that?
Both parents. So just one parent doesn't count.
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
Why is that?
You know, it's very debatable, and a lot of people have an issue with it, and it just is what it is. Why? Because, you know, the research would claim that the greater the stability, the less risk. And that's not to say that just because you lived with both parents till age 16 means it's necessarily stable. But looking at a conglomeration of huge amounts of research, this is what they say. I know, I love it. I'm like, well, the audience is always like, you know, sort of responds to that. All I can say is it's what the literature shows. Maybe in 20 years we'll find something different. Having an antisocial personality disorder, I think that's no surprise. But actually having any personality disorder raises the risk of recidivism. And then having a prior violation. So if you've ever been on parole or probation and violated in the past, that's problematic. Obviously, having a sexual preference for children is problematic. That's a risk factor. Sexual preferences for violence is a risk factor, no surprise. Being sexually entitled. I deserve to get what I want. We have a lot of clients that feel that way, right? Pro-social molester attitudes. She was 15. She was consenting. She was an adult enough, who knew what she was doing, fully developed. There's nothing wrong with having sex with a 15-year-old, right? That's a pro-social molester attitude. Pro-child molester attitude, sorry. Definitely not pro-social. Pro-child molester attitude.
I don't want to judge.
pro-rape attitudes. You know, I cannot tell you how many times at Patton State Hospital did I hear, you know, that B deserved it. I mean, I think I'm being recorded, so I think I won't cuss, but... Let's see, having a lack of an adult lover or partner, as I mentioned, being married or having a partner reduces your risk for recidivism. Being emotionally lonely, socially isolated individuals tend to be more risky. Being very impulsive, no surprise there, right? We see it a lot in frontal lobe disorders and bipolar disorders. Poor problem solving skills, no surprise. Being very callous and unemotional, kind of more of the antisocial, psychopathic, aggressive. Okay, and then here are some more things that are much more treatable. We access to potential victims. If there's a victim pool that's very accessible to them and you remove that victim pool, that tends to help things. Substance abuse, highly correlated with recidivism. We can treat that. Being sexually preoccupied, I mean, the Center for Healthy Sex does a great job in, you know, amongst many things, but just sort of looking at, you know, how can we help people manage their sexual preoccupations? How can we help them change those? An emotional collapse of their support systems, which kind of goes the next two. So again, having fewer support systems in place, you know, we can facilitate an increase of that. Rejection of supervision or of therapy, obviously, that's a problem. And then having a mental illness. Increases recidivism. Do sex offenders have a personality profile? The answer is no. There is no perfect personality profile of a sex offender. All of those things that I just went over are risk factors, but there's no personality profile. So many times attorneys call me and say, can you give an MMPI and let me know if this person's a sex offender? No. The MMPI is not designed to state whether or not they're a sex offender or a child molester. There's no scale that's empirically validated to profile a sex offender. So that is very important, that there's a lot of different types of traits that sex offenders exhibit. But in general, some of the personality characteristics that we do tend to see more of are antisocial personality disorder, a lot of various personality disorders, elevated PCLR scores. The PCLR is the psychopathy checklist. It evaluates for the presence of being a psychopath. Mm-hmm. Psychopaths are sort of more serious forms of antisocial personality disorder. The courts want to know, is he a psychopath? If the person meets criteria for a psychopath, they tend to be the most risky. The MMPI has one scale. The MMPI is a psychological personality instrument. It has one scale called psychopathic deviate, But again, that scale's not designed to tell us whether or not they're a sex offender, just that they have psychopathic traits. Impulsive behavior is highly correlated with problems, and we see that in all sorts of diagnoses, including bipolar. So I already kind of talked about this. Other personality characteristics, looking down here, deviant sexual interests plus having antisocial personality traits is a significant increase for risk for recidivism. So those in combination are kind of things that you want to look at. But also just having sort of an emotional collapse, being depressed, being socially isolated, being manic in a bipolar mania, in impulsivity, is highly correlative with problems. I'm only going to spend 1 minute on this. There's a lot of sex offender risk assessment tools. I want you to have been familiar with them. These are the things that psychologists and psychiatrists are asked to administer as a test to determine whether they have a sex offense risk. The most commonly used one is the static 99. The problem is it's only static factors as opposed to the dynamic factors. The fact that it's most commonly used is concerning because we want to look at dynamic factors in addition to those historic factors that don't change. So the trend now is to combine a static 99, which looks at the historical risk factors, with something like the SRA-FDL, Sex Risk Assessment Forensic Version Light, that's what it stands for. And it looks at more vulnerabilities about the personality that would increase their risk for recidivism and correlate with being a sex offender. All sexual offenders are alike? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Possession of child pornography individuals tend to be the most different from all other sex offenders. They tend to be more reclusive, more socially isolated, and they tend to be more obsessive compulsive. Internet sexual activity is a way to avoid negative feelings and can be very compulsive in nature, almost akin to any other form of addiction. And so possession of child porn, you sort of start to want to thinking about them as you would any other addict. Sex addict is most commonly seen with individuals who are charged with possession of child porn or are in possession of but haven't yet been charged. You know, rapists are so different than possession of child porn individuals. They tend to be very aggressive. They tend to be younger than other pedophiles or child molesters or especially other possession of child porn. They often have been married, whereas most individuals who engage in pedophilia have not been married. Sex offenders do not respond to treatment. Also not true. There's a lot of new studies and models of sex offender treatment that are very encouraging. The newest model for sex offender treatment that's just sort of hitting the books. Because I'm going to a training on it myself. What is the name of that? I want you to know it. It's something like risk needs responsivity model. That might be slightly off, but risk needs responsivity model. Sort of a model of treatment targeting very individualized risk factors and focusing on those risk factors in treatment. And there's really promising research that treatment can assist in reducing sexual recidivism and sex offender proclivities. Sexual offenders have an addiction. Generally, that is more so the case with individuals with possession of child porn than it is for any other type of sex offender. And so as I mentioned, sexual compulsivity does tend to correlate more with possession of child porn than any others. So just a few things on psycholegal issues to sort of wrap up. A lot of times the DA likes to use what's called the Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome as another model that diagnoses the presence of sexual abuse. So, and it's very problematic because there's not a lot of research behind that. There is no profile of a sex offender. Those neural networks get highly reinforced. Yeah. So.
And also, just building on the internet being everywhere, I think that there may be circumstances as well in which somebody might not, in the past, have acted out on a desire,
mm-hmm.
but because they're aware of places that they can go where it's easy to then obtain what they want,
mm-hmm.
it makes it easier for them to act out, and then because it's an addiction, they go somewhere else, like to Thailand or wherever, they come back,
yes.
and it's like, okay, now what do? And then they start acting out here.
Yes. And I've been to Thailand, and I've seen it in action, and wow. Yeah, very good point. Excellent point. Yeah. Good. Well, thank you so much for being here. I know it was really fast, and you know, maybe I'll come back and we'll do phase two, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amen.
Absolutely.